At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to the Point Forward Podcast with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinels, J.R. Radcliffe and Jim Ozarski, an over-caffeinated Milwaukee Bucks conversation.
The Point Forward Podcast. It's not a happy time for Milwaukee Bucks fans. The Milwaukee Bucks, of course, losing in 7 games to the Boston Celtics in the Eastern Conference semifinals. It was a bit of a rough one on Sunday to close it out. The Celtics run away from Milwaukee and move on to the Eastern Conference Finals. Meanwhile, your 2021 champs are left to come home and ponder what's ahead. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the Point Forward Podcast, and on the other line is Jim Ozarski. He covers the Bucks for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We are going to look back at this series with Boston, the 7-game clash, and we'll also look ahead a little bit to what's ahead for the Milwaukee Bucks, but we're not going to do that on this episode. We'll have another episode that looks ahead and looks at some of the roster decisions Milwaukee has to make and what comes next. But for now, Jim, we will look back at this 7-game series. Last we chatted, the Bucks were up 2-1, so it has been a roller coaster since then. Of course, the Bucks lose at home in Game 4, steal one in Game 5 with a ridiculous fourth quarter rally in Boston, setting up Game 6 on Friday night, figured to be an exciting opportunity for Milwaukee. They do not take care of business at home. They go back to Boston and lose there as well. So they are dropped 0-4 against Boston all-time in Game 7s in Milwaukee Bucks history. And Jim, the prevailing theme I think that everybody is kind of pointing to and clinging to is that this is a completely different series with Chris Middleton. I happen to think that's true. I think if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck, he is so key to the things that they were unable to do against Boston. It would have been so different if they had him. Game 7 itself may be a different story, but overall, do you agree with that? Do you think this is a completely different series with Chris Middleton in it, or is maybe that a little overstated as well? Maybe Boston's better than we're giving them credit for.
I think both are true. I think Boston is very, very good and is a worthy participant in the Eastern Conference Finals. But I mean, what I saw over 7 games, JR, was a Bucks team that with Chris Middleton, we're talking about, you know, I'm in Miami right now as we record this. I feel like if Chris Middleton was available for and healthy, not just, you know, a sort of this sort of limping around or whatever version of himself, but if he was good to go, and the guy that he is, yeah. I mean, look, the Bucks just couldn't score, JR. I mean, the Celtics averaged only, what, 105 points a game in this 7-game series. I mean, if you were to tell Mike Budenholzer or any of the Bucks players that before this thing starts, and they're like, oh, we're for sure winning the series. Well, the Bucks didn't even average 100. They didn't even crack the century mark 3 times, JR. They just could not. They could not score. And while we may get into all of those reasons why, the number one reason was because a 3-time All-Star, a 20-point-a-game scorer, a guy who can give you 40 or 35 effortlessly, a guy who creates space for Giannis Antetokounmpo and Drew Holiday, wasn't there. Like, what, you know, it is sort of that simple. They literally, you plug Chris Middleton in for 40 minutes a game. I don't know if it goes 7, but I definitely think it's, you know, the 7th game is going to be closer. And, you know, I think the Bucks advance. Chris Middleton's healthy and plays.
Yeah, Giannis put up some just absurd numbers, historic numbers in this series, and was a one-man wrecking crew. But, you know, like, one-man wrecking crew only works if you have at least somebody to help you out there. And nobody. I mean, Drew Holiday had his moments, certainly, and we could go back if we want and talk about his defense in Game 5 and how huge that was, what a moment that was. But Drew Holiday continued to be pretty inconsistent, especially on offense, and no one else was even remotely close to being enough to help the Bucks prevail. I mean, if you look at the series at large, just take a step back, I think they're kind of lucky to have even pushed it to 7 games. I mean, they stole Game 5 in a performance that I just don't think you could replicate again if you had 10 more tries to do it. And remember, game three at home comes down to a shot that's just late, you know, just off the fingertips of Al Horford, not quite in time for the buzzer. I mean, those are two hard-fought games. They didn't have anything really in reverse. You could argue the Bucks should have won the other home game, game four, other home game that they kind of gave an opportunity away. But for the most part, Boston was pretty clearly the better team in the four games that they won in this series. So unless they steal one more, I think it came down to three-point shooting quite a bit, Jim. I mean, the Bucks obviously were nowhere close to what Boston was able to do on the three-point shooting. I know there was some discussion about the Bucks' willingness to allow three-point shooting. That has been their MO, that they prefer to take away the paint. And I think Mike Budenholzer's response after the game was probably correct in that you could focus on all the times Boston made it. The fact is, the Bucks themselves couldn't answer. They could not make shots from the perimeter. Do you think it was a case of a lot of guys going cold? I mean, is it as simple as saying that nobody could make shots, and that's why they couldn't overcome the absence of Chris Middleton? Or is it more complex than that? Is it the way that Boston defends just makes those three-point looks more difficult or more rushed? Or what it is that contributed to such a woeful disparity in three-point performance between these two teams?
You know, JR, look, I don't know what the stat was for game seven. As we record this, I'm fresh off the plane from Boston. But I know in game six, the Bucks were 2-for-16 on what the NBA considers a wide open look. And, you know, I mean, to me, I think a player might say a wide open look is, you know, they got a guy within a couple feet. I think the NBA is like 4 feet or something like that. I mean, 2-for-16, that's bad. That's just dudes not making shots. Like, you can't, that has nothing to do with Boston or anything. I don't know, again, what that number is for game seven, but it is a consistent theme throughout, Jay. I mean, the guards for the Bucks were 0-for-12 from three. You know, to me, I think Brook Lopez always has an open three at 7 feet tall. You know, 1-for-6. He made 1 3-pointer in the entire series. You know, Pat Connaughton and Bobby Portis' shots went away, aside from, you know, going 6-for-6 in the fourth quarter. You know, in game five, they really didn't make anything. And to the other point, yeah, they said that's the game plan. If Grant Williams and Peyton Pritchard are going to beat you, some of that's a tip of the cap, JR. I don't know, like, how would people feel if we're sitting here doing this and Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown combined for 90 points a game through the series? Like, you can't, like, you know what I mean? Like, you, it's you pick your poison to a degree, and that's what the Bucks do. It's hard to argue that it didn't work. I mean, the Celtics were the best offensive team in basketball efficiency wise, like, since Christmas, or maybe through the, and again, they actually shut them down. I mean, it's 105 points per game, right? That is not like winning basketball most of the time. The Bucks couldn't score outside of Giannis and Drew Holiday. So yeah, JR, I think it was, yes, they made it tough on Giannis. Yes, they made it tough on Drew, just like the Bucks did on Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. The difference in the series was Al Horford had a career game. Grant Williams had two career games. Marcus Smart dropped 21 at one point. And Peyton Pritchard hit 4 threes in a game seven. Where were the Bucks' supporting players? You know what I mean? I like, that's kind of, you hate to say it, but that's sort of was the difference, in my opinion.
Two of the bigger guys that you saw trending on Twitter during this series were George Hill and Grayson Allen. And we could talk about them separately or together. I'll leave it to you. Grayson Allen was phenomenal against Chicago. I think we knew that Boston would be a much tougher matchup for him. He's a guy who, I don't know if it's fair to say he's quite a spot-up shooter exclusively or anything, but that's where he makes, you know, a good chunk of his living. Chicago wasn't able to defend that. Boston held him to 35 points over the entire series, and there were times he didn't look good on really either end of the floor. He wasn't alone, though. I mean, there were a lot of guys who struggled, but you had a lot of fans saying, why is Grayson Allen anywhere near this game? George Hill is the same way, a guy who is a solid defender that Mike Budenholzer trusts very well. but he's in his 30s. He's coming off an injury, and he's a little smaller than you know what Boston offers. So you've got maybe a matchup issue where George Hill isn't quite able to do what he's might be able to do in the regular season. A lot of people wanting Javon Carter. I mean, we've talked about the Javon Carter, George Hill thing. I think it just comes down to Mike Budenholzer just knows and trusts George Hill more. Maybe that was a mistake. I don't know. You can't, I mean, if you say both of those guards can't play, well, somebody's got to soak up those minutes. You know, like Pat Connaughton can't play 40 minutes a game, I don't think, but Wesley Matthews certainly wasn't an offensive juggernaut. You mentioned Portis as well. So I don't really know what the solutions are necessarily being floated as a response to Grayson Allen and George Hill just hurting this team more than helping in this series. But it does seem like those guys came up a lot. So why do you think those guys had the opportunities they had? And do you agree with that those guys were liabilities that Boston was able to take advantage of?
Okay. So I can't say in the last conversation that the supporting players were one of the reasons, the reason the Bucks lost the series, and then not, you know, back that up and say, yeah, they were a problem. I don't know, JR, like where, but like if people just sort of started watching the Bucks in the first round of the season and regular season games that they didn't really care about. Like, let's start with George Hill. They signed George Hill to start the season to a 2-year contract, I believe. I believe he's under contract for $4 million next year, Bucks fans. 36 years old. We can debate John Horst's decision on that. That could be for another time. But they signed George Hill to be the backup point guard, to be a top defender, to give Jrue Holiday a breather, and occasionally hit threes. As the year played out, George got hurt. He couldn't find a shot. He missed a lot of time. So what happens? JR, we could rewind this point forward podcast to when DeAndre Bembry and Javon Carter were signed. What did I say? They need these dudes to get them through the season. That's what happened. Guess what? George Hill got hurt at the end of the season, and it extended into the Bulls series. Javon Carter, we all know, played well. He creates a problem for guys. So now what? George Hill's healthy against the Boston Celtics. Look, you're right with Mike Budenholzer. He loves George. He trusts George. I think Javon Carter earned some trust as well. But clearly, the coaching staff felt like George was the best option. Now, he's 6'4", probably a 6'6 wingspan, 6'5 wingspan. He's just a bigger dude. I don't know if, you know, Jason Tatum is going to have no problems with Javon Carter. Like, I don't know what else people are thinking about that. Like, Javon Carter wasn't going to come in the game and defend Marcus Smart or Peyton Pritchard. Like, that's not how the matchups work. Because they didn't want Giannis over there on those guys. They didn't want Jrue over there on those. Like, that's – so you're right. That's the one-for-one option. So George doesn't take a shot. Does Javon take a shot? I don't think so. Javon took a couple jumpers in the regular season because that's what you do. I definitely saw him not take shots in the Chicago series. So it's not like Javon's going to come in and give you 11 points. So I don't know if this is residual George Hill from 3 years ago, JR. Like, I don't know. I mean, you can maybe answer that a little better than I can, but so there's that. So I'll let you kind of fill in some gaps there for George. We'll get to Grayson here in a minute, but I do reserve the right to defend myself or the blame the media guy was out full force. You know, ask Bud the hard questions. Why doesn't we ask why George Hill plays? We asked as soon as George played game one, we asked Mike Budenholzer, what do you like about George that he's going to play? And what does he say? We like his size. We like his defense. We like his ball, like all the things. And then in the series against the Celtics, why do you play George Hill 23 minutes? And he gives you the same answer. Like, I don't quite understand what people want on that. you know, it's more of a listener fan issue and with the head coach than us. But I don't know. Like the George Javon thing, Like, I get it. It's like the backup. Like, Bucks fans sound like Bears fans in this one. Like, the backup quarterback just must be this amazing person because he's right. Like, they saw him throw some touchdowns in the preseason, you know? So I don't know, JR. I don't know if that's look, George Hill didn't have a good playoff. He's dealing with what, a torn disc in his neck and a torn oblique muscle. And clearly they thought he was better than Javon Carter, even with all that. I don't really know any other, I don't have any other answer to that. Right. Other than that's just what they did. I get it, but Mike Budenholzer is fairly clear on why he was doing it. I just think nobody likes that reason.
Yeah, I think that's it. The reason is that he just thinks George Hill is better. And that might be an accurate evaluation, you know. And I said George Hill isn't. I mentioned like it was a size thing. I mean, George Hill is obviously taller than Javon Carter by quite a bit. It's just that, you know, Javon Carter's a little thicker. But I think in Mike Budenholzer's mind, they're gonna get the same results whether or not it's George Hill or Javon Carter, at least on one end of the floor. I think if you're a fan, you're saying at least try something different because you can see what's not working. So you automatically, like you said, with the backup quarterback thing, you want to go to the unknown, go behind door number two. Javon Carter had a solid regular season, especially given that he was kind of a, you know, they got him for basically nothing. So I could see why there is some, let's try door number two because door number one clearly isn't working. It comes back to the adjustments thing with Mike Budenholzer. I am with you though. It wouldn't have made a difference on the end that really mattered, and that's the offensive end. Like defensively, you can take issue with the 3-point thing if you want. This is how they play. They've had tons of success with it. They won a title doing it last year. Teams bombed away on them last year too in the playoffs. It didn't matter because they were able to execute everything else because they had their full complement of guys. So I think. Offensively, it would not have made a difference. Javon Carter is not going to suddenly hit 4 threes or, you know, drive to the basket. He might get a shot up here or there that George Hill doesn't take. But, you know, we're talking about improving around the margins against a team that is just playing, is just better than you over the course of the series. So I can understand Budenholzer going with the veteran guy.
That's near, like, they played like early 2000s level, not sort of the Celtics. But the Bucks played like early 2000s level NBA defense. So, like, Javon Carter's just not that dude. Like, he's just not. Like, he's not giving you 12 points. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah. And as for Grayson Allen, I do think you could tie this into, will the Bucks look ahead as they look ahead? And again, we'll talk about this on the next podcast, but do they want to commit to that guy? Because, you know, obviously this is the part of the season the Bucks fans care about the most. The Bucks themselves care about the most. They know over the course of the regular season, probably no matter what, they're going to be in the Eastern Conference semifinals. You know, that's where the real basketball begins. That's where the playoff basketball begins. We talked about what a 16-game player was last year, PJ Tucker being the foremost example. You know, is Grayson Allen capable of being a difference maker against a team like the Boston Celtics? Because you better believe the Bucks are going to be an Eastern Conference semifinals team again next year, and they're going to play a team like the Boston Celtics in this spot next year. So I don't know if looking at the limited data you get from this 7-game series, you could say, man, maybe Grayson Allen isn't a fit for what they're doing. But that also feels a little unfair because, again, he did just have a really good series against the Bulls, two totally different defenses, but like I don't know. I can understand the confusion with Grayson Allen. Not that he played, the confusion that what do you do with him? What happens with him next? Is he somebody who can help this team when they get into the postseason? Because I do think that's a question mark.
I think the short answer is yes. I mean, he's a huge reason why they got out of the first round of the playoffs without Chris Middleton. I think just what you know, he ended up catching whatever the shooting flu was that everybody else caught, JR. I mean, you look, the championship run is always going to be, and this is what's the bad thing for future teams, right, that invariably follow a championship season. There's always the comparison. His first round was not unlike Bryn Forbes against Miami. Bryn Forbes outscores Jimmy Butler. Did we ever mention Bryn Forbes again?
And they won a title, so we don't care that Bryn Forbes absolutely went on the face of became face on a milk carton after that.
Right? Bobby Portis, quite famously, did not play against the Brooklyn Nets. Where's Bobby? Not a good matchup. Well, guess what? Bobby Portis shows up again in the next two rounds. That's the nature of supporting players with this type of roster construct. It's built around the big three. And everybody else is better when the entire three are there. We talked about this during the season, JR. Like the Bucks won 78% of the time when the big three played. They were about 500 or less if they didn't. And that was with two of the three playing, because it's that trickle-down effect. It's all of a sudden, no, you don't want Pat Connaughton playing 40 minutes. You just don't. Like, that, he's not that guy. Like, Grayson Allen's not that guy. Bobby Portis is not that guy. Like, so there's that trickle-down effect. And, yeah, Grayson got open and did the thing against the Bulls. Well, guess what? The Celtics are a better defensive team. Grayson's drives to the lane were more contested. You know, he made threes, just like everybody else, not enough. As we kind of spin it forward, we can really dive into, a potential long-term fit beyond just his extension. But, like, at least in this series, JR, sure, I know people went nuts in game six, right, because of plus-minus. Well, look, the Bucks, like, plus-minus figures in this series, like, everybody's isn't great. You know, like, the starters didn't finish the game in three of them. So, you know, like, when the starters are sitting on the bench because, you know, it's over before the final three, like, everyone's plus minus is garbage. Grayson actually had some really solid defensive plays in game seven. He was a big part of why they were in it, you know, on the defensive end, even though he couldn't make a shot. So I think there's potential there. He, again, very, very important part of, you know, why they were able to overcome the Bulls. It's just, like everybody else, it caught up with them, you know, against a better team when the shots weren't going in.
All right, let's relitigate something. This trade from earlier in the season, the deal, Dante DiVincenzo, that the Bucks gave up in exchange for Serge Ibaka. Serge Ibaka did not play meaningful minutes in this series. I think he only played three total. When they got him, that was a situation where Brooke Lopez was out. It was unclear what his long-term prognosis would be. Wasn't clear if he'd be available or at least full strength for the postseason. So that was all baked into that decision-making. And then we get to the postseason, and Brooke Lopez is quite healthy, had a great finish to the regular season. I think did mostly what he could do. He wasn't, you know, huge offensively. I don't know if that's a function of just how the Celtics work. Like, it's hard to get that guy free offensively sometimes. I still think he was a major factor. And Serge Ibaka didn't play. I don't think adding Dante DiVincenzo to the mix instead really frees up anything or helps them out enough to the point where they could tip the scales one way or the other. But I suppose you could argue that trade ultimately does nothing for them in the postseason, and they gave up an asset in Dante DiVincenzo. If Bucks fans want to really wallow in it, they can go back and look at the PJ Tucker, the decision not to keep PJ Tucker. If you only care about this stage of the season and discount the regular season and you know, see that the luxury tax played a small role in that decision, you could maybe say, well, it would have been nice to have him, even though, again, it wasn't on the defensive end that this team really struggled. So mainly I'm thinking about this Ibaka deal. Do you think, looking back on it, it ends up, history looks back on this and says that was a pretty big miscalculation by the Bucks? Or do you think it just kind of gets forgotten as sort of a footnote, because Dante DiVincenzo wouldn't have made much difference anyway?
I think because they lost and Serge didn't play at all, it'll always kind of be a what if, because this fits into the, well, if you don't trade Dante, then you don't add Javon Carter. And in that instance, Dante's probably playing more than George Hill is.
Absolutely agree, yes.
So, because at that point, Dante's in year five, whatever year this was for him, year four or five, been part of, you know, started during the title run. But yeah, like let's be real. I mean, Dante DiVincenzo's not making 40% of his threes, you know, but he's you know, more like Grayson Allen in than maybe people realize, or in that, you know, he likes to get to the basket. You know, his 3-point shot, would it have returned in his limited bench minutes? Because that's what would have happened. Like, Grayson was the starter, you know, and Grayson started 65 games until it was the end of the year, and it was time for Wes Matthews to you know, ramp up. So Dante was going to be that seventh, eighth, you know, guy. So I think it'll always kind of be a what if, JR. Yeah, because Serge didn't play. You know, and there's a lot of what ifs down the line there. But yeah, I don't think Dante, I think it might be wistful thinking, you know, like, yeah, Dante had a great season before he got hurt against the Heat. Let's make no mistake about it. I mean, he really improved. Big reason why they won it, they got to the playoffs. I think because of that, it's, yeah, but it's hard to look back and say, wow, Dante DiVincenzo would have been the X factor in this series. I don't know what in his career, JR, showed that. If anything, like the Bucks did to Grant Williams, like the Celtics would do to Dante. They would say, all right, Dante, you shoot it 15 times, and if you beat us, well, then that's, you know what I'm saying? So, I don't know. But yeah, it'll be interesting. We'll, you know, I don't know when we'll talk to John Horst again. You know, if he'll be available here after the season or if it's after the draft, but that'll be a question for him. You know, what, how did that play out in your mind when you made the deal? Because I can't imagine they expected him to not play at all after trading for Serge Ibaka.
Before I move into something a little different, let me ask you this about Chris Middleton. Going back to Chris Middleton, do you have any sense of how close he may have been to playing? You know, there was obviously some hope amongst Bucks fans that they might see him in an elimination game. Obviously, he did not play in Game 7. Did you get any sense that there might be a chance he'd play, or did you have a feeling that this wasn't going to happen? Maybe he doesn't play at all in this postseason, no matter how it goes. I have no idea.
No, he was. I mean, he had started light contact and court work as that series began. And my understanding, JR, is, you know, right before Game 6, they kind of put him through the last sort of tests to see, can you play NBA basketball? And he just couldn't. He just couldn't do it. You know, so it was, so like, yes, he was close in that they were excited and they were able to get him to that stage to give him that workout or those workouts to see, like, can you move laterally? Can you do these things? And then he just wasn't ready to go. So on one hand, someone listening to this might say, well, that means he wasn't close at all. But I think the fact that he was able to ramp up and there was some optimism, that's for sure. Like, going into Game 6, there was optimism that he could go. And then I think it just didn't bear out that way.
Will be one of the biggest what-ifs in Bucks history, I suppose. Of course, Bucks fans know this acutely well. Injuries played a huge role in Brooklyn for the Brooklyn Nets last year, and a big reason why the Bucks were able to advance past them by the skin of their teeth in the Eastern Conference semifinals. So it's a give-and-take situation. The Bucks season is over. If they were able to stay healthy, might be a different story. All right, I know you don't like talking about officiating, but I do want to get into a couple aspects of it. The Boston Celtics, and many teams in the NBA, but Boston seems particularly, I'm just going to say it, they're good at this. They're good at flopping. They're good at selling contact. Marcus Smart in particular, although he had a couple funny moments during the series where it was notably not well sold. Game 5 comes to mind when Jrue Holiday just simply took it away from him at midcourt. It seemed to be something that was, I wouldn't say completely effective, like we said on the last podcast. Them not falling over and standing their ground is a better defense for the Bucks, and was one of the things that gave them problems. But there were several instances where it sure seemed like they sold the contact well. I thought there were a couple instances where the Bucks did the same thing. Ime Udoka made a comment that after he was frustrated with a game's worth of officiating, said that he should encourage his guys to flop more. You know, I think we can roll our eyes at that. But does flopping work? As much as it looks like on TV, is it something that's become this soccer-like art form across the NBA, especially in the playoffs, especially in high-level playoff basketball. And is there anything the NBA can do to stop it? You hear a lot of ban the charge on Twitter, but no one, I don't think, is really can really take that seriously. You can't just outright ban the charge. So I don't know what really can be done about it, but it does feel like it is taking over games, at least as people are watching it, the watching experience. It does seem like it's a little more prevalent than maybe it should be.
My gut reaction is that flopping does, like, actual flopping doesn't work. You know, when this first was instituted into the league, you know, when players in the NBA started doing it more often, I mean, there actually was the anti-flop call. There was, if you flop, that guy was called for a foul. Remember that little period?
Yes.
They don't call that anymore. And I think part of it is because officials are better at recognizing what's ridiculous and what's not. I don't know if there's a cumulative effect to it, you know, falling around and falling down and falling down. And finally, I think for the most part, you know, you're talking about judgment calls. There's always going to be mistakes. I don't think flops are rewarded. I really don't. I think if there's a charge or there's an illegal screen, I'm sure if you go back and look at it, it's right more often than not. I hate to say it. I know it maybe sounds riding the fence, but I just don't, you know, I feel like, you know, staying on your feet is a better defense. And maybe if you do that most of the time and then you hit the court, maybe you can sell it. You know, some guys earn some rights. Drew Holiday flat out says, like, a guy like me gets more benefit of the doubt in the playoffs. For stuff. Now, Drew doesn't fall. Drew, you know, he's not that kind of guy. But, you know, Marcus Smart does. I don't know if Marcus got a ton of those, you know. Alex Caruso took real charges from Giannis in the first round. So, yeah, I get it. It's annoying. You know, Grant Williams laying on the court, holding his face, and then...
Yeah, hitting
a look,
three.
That came back and bit him, you know, in game five. You know, I think one of the reasons the Bucks hit all those threes was because those dudes were laying on the floor, you know? So I don't know. I feel like it works the other way too, when you're doing that, you know, where the refs are just like, that's not like, you're not doing anything there. So that's just me. I don't know. Maybe there's a listener at PFP want to tweet me a bunch of videos and clips and show me, but, I feel like it's like baseball umpiring to a degree. And they get it right more often. It's just their bodies are just falling all over all the time. So it's just annoying. And it totally is annoying. And so when it finally is called, it just exacerbates it.
Maybe a bigger question about officiating. Is there something you think does need a greater analysis, greater, you know, a change, something that needs greater attention? That is particularly frustrating, or do you feel like, I mean, like you said, bodies flying everywhere, the greatest athletes in the world. Maybe this is just the best that they can do, and it's not even, you know, it's not as bad as you think, first of all. And second of all, it's legitimately an impossible task otherwise.
I think, honestly, the only thing I think the NBA could do is say, there's two things. Once a player's in the air, you cannot get underneath him. That would be a big change, because I feel like you get a lot of unnecessary contact and bodies flying around when a guy already lifts off and there's that slide underneath. So there's that. And then the other thing, JR, is I think quite simply you can say, I guess you can't say don't fall over, because sometimes, like, Giannis is 250 pounds. Like, Giannis is going to knock you on your ass. And so, like, that. So, I on one hand, I feel like you can't just say, don't fall over. But I feel like if you fall over, you know, odds are, like, you can't call it a flop, but you know what? Maybe you weren't in the best position because you fell over. Like, why are you falling over? That means your feet aren't set. That means you're not in a right. You know what I mean? So maybe there's some sort of language or emphasis that you can have that can, like, JRD, the night game, like Cam Johnson, I think, went like sliding 20 feet off a little, like, you know, forearm from Luka Doncic, and he's laying there and Luka's just wide open, hits a three. Like, what are you, like, you hurt your team by doing that mess, right? Like, so it's just like Marcus Smart with at the end of game five, like, play the ball, man. Don't be, you know, turn into a meme. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know. That's, those aren't great answers, but I feel like maybe that's something they could do. Maybe.
Yeah. The rebound that Bobby Portis put back, a couple of Celtics players fighting for it. But I think there was some criticism that Marcus Smart maybe was a little more interested in trying to collect some contact there. And that was part of the reason why that ball bounded into Bobby Portis's hands for the go-ahead putback in game five. So yeah. And if no call is made, well, now you've got a 5-on-4 because one dude's on the ground. So, and Giannis is going to dunk over that, which he did with extreme prejudice in a couple occasions in this series. So, my big thing for officiating is pretty simple. The challenge system needs to be expanded. It's either two challenges per team, or if you successfully get your challenge correct, you get another one, because there's too many calls that are, I won't say they're obvious necessarily on the floor, but they're pretty obvious on replay. And then you've burned your challenge over something that should have 100% gone your way. In baseball, they work it that way. In football, they work it that way. You should absolutely do that in the NBA as well. I think they probably will. I think that just makes sense. You're not subtracting a whole lot from the game to credit that. Drew Holiday is a fascinating case, Jim, because after game five, I think, you know, we were already, Bucks fans were ready to build another statue, have it be Drew Holiday, after his incredible block and steal against Marcus Smart in the final 10 seconds. That is just vintage Drew Holiday. He's one of the best defenders in the league, and we saw it in this series. And occasionally on offense, he was very good. That fourth quarter in game five, probably the best single quarter non-Giannis edition of any Bucks player in the playoffs total. Maybe Grayson's got one in there from the Bulls series. I don't remember for sure. But Drew Holiday at times is awesome. He's also very inconsistent offensively, and that has been the case in both playoffs where the Bucks have seen him. That was the case last year as well. And I don't know how to evaluate him. I mean, he is central to what they do. When he is absent, this Bucks team was pretty rudderless. And I would say that that's even more the case than the times they were without Chris this year, when one of the big three was missing. Drew seemed to have as great an impact, really, as when Giannis was out of the lineup. So I know he's essential, but it does seem like there were times where he just really struggled. He went through some real stretches of turnovers and bad shots and missed shots. How do you evaluate Drew Holiday? I mean, he's obviously getting older too in his career. Like, I don't even know what to say about him. Like, I know he's good. I don't know if he's great because of what we've seen in the playoffs. I think he's great. I really don't know. How do you explain the Drew Holiday, you know, the Drew Holiday experience, Jim?
Yeah, first of all, I mean, he is the perfect third guy for Giannis and Chris Middleton.
Absolutely true.
So that I don't think is deniable in any way from what we've seen over 2 years. So, but your question is playoff centric. So last year, I mean, last season or two seasons ago now, you know, the Bucks as a team couldn't make any threes. So, you know, that's 2 years in a row now that. So he shot 40% from the field, 30% from 3-point line. And he averaged, let's call it 17 shots a game in the playoff run to a title. He came back this year. So Drew Holiday had one of his most efficient offensive seasons. You know, he shot 50% from the field. You know, again, he did that two seasons ago. Career best, 41% from three. You know, and one of the reasons for that, you know, he averaged 18.3 points a game, but JR, coming to the Bucks, he only averaged 14 shots a game, which makes sense because he's the third guy, right? And so it fit offensively, that fit him, right? He expends a lot of energy on defense, picks his spot on offense. Well, guess what? Playoffs this year, no Chris Middleton. JR, he was putting up almost 20 shots a game. He's not that guy. Like, obviously, he's talented enough to attempt to be that guy, and the Bucks felt, obviously, he's clearly was the second best player on the team, healthy. And so, yeah, he really struggled, man. 38% from the field, 31% from three, but just way, way more shots. And I don't, whereas last year, JR, I was curious about that. Like, oh, and he kind of, in his play kind of tapered down a bit during last regular season, and it carried into the playoffs. Whereas this year it was the opposite. I mean, he was leading the Bucks in fourth quarter scoring going into the postseason. He was clutch, a ton of points, and then Chris gets hurt. And now Drew Holiday's got to take 30 shots or 27 shots or 20. And that's just not his – that's not his game. I guarantee you, JR, this goes back to the very start of this podcast. If Chris Middleton is taking 20 shots a game, he's scoring 28 or 30 points. You know what I mean? Like, that's what he's doing. Whereas Drew is working so hard to score 19 points a game on 20 shots. Like, not great efficiency at all. So I don't, man, I feel like it's last year. I don't know. This year, I feel is very clear that no Chris Middleton really, really created an issue for the Bucks, not only, but Drew Holiday, especially, as he really had to change his offensive game.
It's really kind of amazing, as hard as he works on defense, that he was even available to have a great fourth quarter on offense in any game, because he certainly delivers on one on the floor. And that's pretty enlightening how you put it there. That kind of opens my eyes a little bit too. Like, he was asked, he had to do more because there was no one else to do it. And he did what he could. It's just, it's not his wheelhouse to be a volume shooter type of person. On the bigger picture, you were there on, obviously on Friday night, game six in Milwaukee. After the game, there were shootings, there was violence kind of right around the Deer District area. I know that you were not in the mix for that. You weren't outside. I know you saw some of the commotion inside the building. It was a shooting that took place about a block from the Deer District, and then two other shootings not far from there, about a block from that location. So not necessarily like in the plaza, for those who don't know the geography. This isn't on the concrete in front of the building necessarily, but it's close enough that you can certainly hear the gunshots. And obviously there were some people running away. I feel like, Jim, you know, it's probably overstating it, but man, did that feel like sort of an end of an innocent era, you know? Like, It was the end of the season, the last Deer District, you know, home game. They canceled the Deer District watch party for Game 7 because of the police still, you know, needing the area somewhat secure, and certainly security and safety issues. And now, you know, it's tied into Milwaukee's legacy of gun violence, which is not ideal. And now I don't know what we're going to see with the Deer District going forward, but I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. It just really kind of a crushing, you know, sort of parallel loss to the loss of the Bucks team in general. The fact that now, I don't know if Deer District is going to be the same. I don't know if they're ever going to be able to recapture the joy of that moment, knowing that this sort of violent incident is going to be tied to it a little bit. I don't know. I mean, maybe you could just kind of convey what you saw inside the building and kind of what the status was, what the chaos was there, and just kind of what you think about it all.
Yeah, obviously, in the moment, so we were just getting into the press conference area when news is starting to break. So I headed back into the bowl because there was some initial reporting or thoughts that people were trying to get back into the arena. I don't believe that was true, which makes sense. Like, I don't think if there's what's believed to be an active shooter situation, they would just let people, whomever, into an enclosed building. And so there was not a whole lot of great communication or chatter in there. I mean, like the game had ended and people had left. So in the building, it was a little unclear as to what was happening, and the extent of it. And obviously as the night wore on, more incidents occurred. Yeah. JR, I don't know. You know, two seasons ago, Deer District post COVID, never happened before, 65,000, like, it, that was removed anyway, I believe, right? The plaza was cordoned off, gated off, VIP tickets were being sold to diminish, like, so I think that whole thing was already, and that, I don't think had anything to, I mean, maybe there was a safety issue, maybe the city and the Bucks went back, was like, look, that went great, all things considered, but we probably shouldn't allow that to happen again. I don't know. but it was, I think max capacity JR was 11,000. So, and what I was told, I've never been to the Deer District with that scenario. So I was told to get into that like actual space, there is metal detector, there are metal detectors, security, winding, whatever it may be. Now as you expand out, yes, I don't know. I mean, that's just, you know, people, you know what I'm saying? And I just feel like, I don't know how that can be more widely enforced or changed. I mean, maybe you have certain people who will always remember that and never come down. I don't know, you know, maybe that it entices the people who can get into the Deer District, and then it has to be dispersed and you can't have like the million, I don't know, but there's bars. There's like that whole district. I mean, that street's been there. I don't know. How long is MLK /3? I mean, it's forever, right? Like, what are you going to do with that? Like, I think that those are those streets, water. They're like, so I don't know, JR, like on one hand, you're right. I don't think it'll be forgotten. It shouldn't be in terms of public safety and planning and all that stuff. But I think it already had changed from the title to be more corporate, to be more, you know, Bucksy. Like, I just feel like that was already removed. And this obviously is a stain, but I don't know what else can be done after that.
Yeah. We are not going to go with our normal features, one quick buck and what's making Jim mad. Maybe we could stick one on to the end of the next podcast looking ahead, but this is obviously already running a little bit long, but I do want to, on a little bit of a lighter note, get into one thing that's making me mad, and you can feel free to chime in. This is a line that I heard from Celtics coach Ime Udoka. I heard it from fans of the Celtics, certainly. The idea that the Bucks sort of made their own bed by resting starters the last game of the season. And if people remember, the last game of the season, the Bucks, if they had won or if the Celtics had lost, the Bucks would have been the 2 seed, the Celtics the 3. They ended up with the exact same record, so the Celtics had the tiebreaker. The Bucks chose to essentially punt on the last game. I don't think it's unfair to say that was the case. They rested all their starters. They lost that game. Celtics played a Memphis team that was doing likewise, punting all of their starters, so the Celtics had no problem winning. They secured the 2 seed and then ultimately had home court advantage in this series. Ime Udoka commenting that, you know, that maybe they curried a little favor with the basketball gods by doing things, you know, the right way. That's not his words, but like air quotes and roll your eyes over right way. And therefore, they had home court advantage for Game 7. Now, I think that is a really stupid thing to say or point out in a series in which the road team won on 4 occasions. 4 of the 7 games were won by the road team. So I don't know if home court advantage is really the thing that won anybody any contest here. The Bucks had a chance with their own home court advantage to steal things off in Game 6. They did not do it. So I don't really understand why anyone would look at it quite that way. I mean, I know that was a storyline kind of late in the season and then, you know, sort of in the background simmering throughout this series, knowing that the Bucks theoretically could have had the 2 seed if they had elected to play their starters on the last game of the season. But I mean, we've talked about how this Bucks team just never really cared about that sort of thing. They never really felt they were in trouble on the road. They won 2 road series last year en route to winning the NBA title. And technically they lost home court advantage in Game 1 against the Hawks in the Eastern Conference Finals too. So they won a couple road games in that contest to win it by 6. They've never cared about that sort of thing. I don't think home court advantage was the difference for the Celtics in Game 7. I don't think any venue change alters what was a 26 point spread. So I find that to be a little disingenuous. I don't know how you feel about it, but I'm just like, of all the things to criticize the Bucks for, I just don't think that's it. I think they took an advantage to rest their guys knowing that they were comfortable with whatever scenario they had. The Celtics rested players late in the season. Jason Tatum and Al Horford against the Bucks weren't playing. I mean, maybe they were hurt, but still, you take your opportunities to rest your guys. So I don't know how you feel about that, Jim, but to me, that's just one of the more annoying subplots that have sprouted up after this series.
Yeah, it's... And look, I know there's some fans that have been mad about that, still mad about it. Home court. Look, the Suns won 64 games and then what was down by 46 at home in Game 7. Like, the home court is not what it used to be. I know some people may not disagree. the Celtics and Bucks prove that. I mean, maybe if Mike Boonholzer is available to us, maybe we'll ask him to see if he looks back. But I know what he's going to say. He's going to say, no, we were comfortable with what we did. I mean, to me, this just fits into the whole, like, the unknown. Well, if they only would have played game 82 and Javon Carter plays in the playoffs, like, and Luka Vildoza gets his minutes.
Oh, Luka.
You know, again, as you said, willfully glossing over losing at home in game 6, hashtag Bucks in 6, you know, like they had home court. So, you know, it's like, I don't know. It is the what if game. If you were to tell Mike Budenholzer before that Cleveland game, hey, just so you know, Chris Middleton's going to sprain his MCL in a couple days and you're not going to have him for any, like, maybe you should play this game. Like, well, okay, then maybe they do. Right. Like, I don't know, but I don't know if this series goes any different because it might have just been Boston winning in game 7 on the road, like without Chris Middleton. So, yeah, I think it's just one of those things when the team is eliminated, JR, the final, you know, little pieces of, you know, corn, popcorn between your teeth that you never got out, but you were living with for a while. Like, you're just like, oh, it's still there. So I'm going to yell about this thing. And if, look, the Celtics, they have personalities. They like to talk. And if they feel that was a thing for them, then, you know, they won. They get to say it.
You've just opened my eyes. I mean, I saw the Western Conference Game 7. Luka is the key to Game 7 victory. So I don't know why the Bucks didn't deploy their Luka.
I mean, exactly.
Shameful missed opportunity. Jim, I got nothing else for you, but I'll leave you with one last question. And if you want to add anything else, feel free. But do you think the Celtics team is going to win the NBA championship?
Yes.
Yeah, I do too. I think they're going to win.
I think Golden State will probably beat Dallas. But I think Boston, the way they play, they're a better matchup for the Warriors than even the Bucks were. Oh my God. Can you imagine a Warriors Bucks final where the Bucks pack the paint and the Splash Brothers, and, you know, you're going to let those dudes shoot 83s. Okay. Like, I would have been fascinated to see how Bud would have done that.
The race to 33 pointers is on.
You know what I mean? Like, that would have been, like, I don't, like, Brooke Lopez might not have played in the NBA finals. You know what I mean? Like, it would have been wild. So, yeah, I think I do. I and this is no disrespect to Miami. I have maintained throughout the year they are a true one seed and have been so good. So we'll see. But, yeah, I do think the Celtics are, to me, would be the favorite. They won't be the favorite on any lines or any of that stuff. But that, you know, I don't know. I thought the Bucks would win in 7. So what do I know this year?
Oh, yes, you absolutely know nothing, which will not stop me from bringing you back for another episode of Point Forward Podcast as we look ahead to, we can talk about Brooke Lopez, we'll go back about Grayson Allen a little bit, and I'm sure there'll be more that we can discuss as we look ahead to the job John Horst has in trying to get this team back to this very same spot next year. Hey, thanks for joining us, Jim. It's been fun. It was a long one, and it's a rare opportunity for vacation now for you. So this is going to be a very surreal headspace for you. Congratulations on that, and we will chat with you again very soon.
All right, sounds good, JR. Talk to you then.
Find us on Stitcher, Spotify, or Apple Podcast. You know where to find us. You found us already, but feel free to reach out on Twitter. I'm at JR Radcliffe. He's at Jim Ozarski. Let us know what you think. Thanks for listening with us. Again, we will have another podcast soon looking ahead, but thanks again for tuning in throughout this playoff run and throughout this season. Thank you. We will check in with you again very soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Point Forward Podcast, a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and JSOnline.com production.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help you save. Selection varies by location while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.